Grace and peace to all of you. It's good to be here. And I think the last time we had a service, I was asked to speak. I'm not sure why. I got the opportunity again. I really enjoy it out here. I'm sorry that not all of you can see. I did notice, Ken, you asked me to come up here, but I think I'm down here, which I think is how it should be. We certainly live in interesting times, and I was meditating on what to share for a message this morning, and my mind was drawn to the life and times of Samuel in the Old Testament. And if you think that we live in turbulent times or interesting times politically, or there is lots of turmoil or unrest, all you need to reset your perspective is to read the book of Judges, Ruth, and Samuel. Very interesting times. Some really strange things were happening, and I'd like to talk about that. The message title for today is called One Who Honors God, The Life of Samuel. I'll be reading some out of the books of Judges and Samuel for the sake of time. I don't plan to read large sections of Scripture this morning. There's so much we could read, and I don't know about you, but for me, large sections of large numbers of chapters, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around it just reading it. And so for me, listening to somebody read it is an effective way for me to get my mind wrapped around it. It was very helpful for me to listen to large sections of chapters from the book of 1 Samuel. And if you listen to it, it almost sounds like a story, a very interesting and fascinating story that's happening here in this time period. About 1100 BC is approximately the time period we're talking about here. And to give you a sense of the place that we find Samuel and where he was in history, I'd like to read from the book of Judges. And I think we all know that after Joshua passed away, God had leaders in Israel who were called judges. And at this time, you'll notice in the Bible that God is called the Lord of hosts, or God is called the leader of the armies of Israel. And as Israel fought its battles, God was recognized as the one who was the head of the armed forces. But what about the civil state? What about the ordinary goings-on of daily life? Well, periodically in this time period, different individuals would step forward, and either they would rally the nation in time of crisis. Just think of Samson and his rallying God's people. There were lots of others. Jephthah comes to mind. Othniel, and there was a number of others, people who stepped forward to rally the nation and provide some civil authority. I think that's why they were called judges. They stepped up to give some direction to the people, and in a limited way, they spoke to all Israel. It's not clear that they exercised control in a significant way, but they spoke into what was happening. The situation, though, in Israel seems rather unsettled and tenuous. I just wanted to read a few verses that kind of that illustrate this. This is from the end of the book of Judges in chapter 20. Just wanted to read a few verses here. There was lots of failures among the people. There's lots of sin, lots of disobedience. And just as a case in point, in the end of the book of Judges, there's a situation where this man from Benjamin is traveling through another tribe and doesn't get the hospitality he expects, and isn't taken in for the night. And his solution to that is to start a war. It seems strange to my mind why he went to the lengths he did, but that's indeed what happened. And he called this man who has refused hospitality called all Israel together, and in chapter 20, they have God's blessing on this. He says, then all the children of Israel, in verse 26 of chapter 20, all the children of Israel and all the people went up and came into the house of God and wept and sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until even and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And I'm just going to tell you part of the story here. They asked God whether they should go up in battle against Benjamin, and God told them to go up, and they fought against Benjamin and destroyed the tribe of Benjamin. It's hard to imagine how God gave his blessing to that. But the summary really comes in the last two verses of the book of Judges, where it says, and the children of Israel departed thence. This is after the whole episode with Benjamin was over. It says, the children of Israel departed thence at that time, every man to his tribe and to his family, and they went out from thence, every man to his inheritance. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And I think that's a concise summary of what the condition in Israel was at this time. Everyone just did what they thought the best thing to do. That was both in, I think, the civil sense and in the religious sense. It seems like whatever you decided was the appropriate thing, that's what you did. And occasionally, you would have people who would try to set some semblance of order to this. You also did have the presence of God. And at this point in Israel's history, the tabernacle is at Shiloh. And if you read through the book of Joshua and Judges, you find that Israel as a nation went traveling throughout Canaan, conquering and subduing the land from the Canaanites. And as they finish up their sweep around the territory, they come back to Shiloh, which is just north of Jerusalem. And they set the tabernacle for one last time. And everybody disperses to their tribe. Everybody goes to their inheritance. The tribe of Levi wasn't given an inheritance in a specific area. And if you remember your Bible history, you'll remember that was as a punishment for their ancestors' brutality. And the tribe of Levi was scattered throughout Israel. And so descendants of Levi were there at Shiloh, at the tabernacle, leading worship at Shiloh, but they were also placed in various places throughout Israel. Various cities were given to the Levites to be their city. Since there was no need to move the tabernacle anymore, only the priests were needed there at Shiloh. If you read about the tabernacle, you'll know there were other families and whole courses of priests and courses of Levites who would move the tabernacle, be responsible for the various furniture and so forth. But as the tabernacle comes to rest at Shiloh, it seems like the group of religious leaders narrows down, and it's usually just one man or several men who are leading worship there at Shiloh. But in all of this, there seems to have been a lot of spiritual decay in the nation of Israel. We could take the priest at the time, the priest of God at this time is Eli. And Eli does seem to have a knowledge of God, some knowledge of what is right and wrong. God does speak to him. But the Bible tells us clearly in the book of Samuel and that Eli's sons are wicked. And as I read the story in the book of Samuel, it's hard for me to understand how they could be this wicked and still be involved in the worship of God. And I think that should tell us something about the state of Israel at this time. If you read the story, you'll find out that among the list of things that the Bible tells us they were doing wrongly was the Israelites would bring meat to offer. And so what would happen is the Israelite would bring his cow or his sheep to the tabernacle. The priest would kill it, would offer the blood and the fat to God as an offering, and then would sit down for a meal there and cook the meat and eat it. Well, the priests, since they were there serving the tabernacle and not running their own farms or managing their own income source, they were to have a portion of the food that the Israelites are bringing as sacrifice. Well, it seems like Eli's sons got dissatisfied with this and would do things like saying we get to have what you bring to eat first before you choose. So give us the best part of it. The fat was always supposed to be offered to God. And sometimes it says that Eli's sons would say, we don't feel like having roast beef today. We want grilled steak instead. Clearly not in line with God's instructions to them, but is what they wanted. It was what they wanted. Not only that, they were immoral. There was lots of immorality happening between the priests and people who were coming to worship. The Bible calls them, frankly, sons of Belial. They were wicked men. And it says, people abhorred the offering of the Lord. In other words, people were repulsed from coming to worship God at Shiloh because of the wickedness of the priests. Not only that, it feels like there was a general lack of hearing from God. In Samuel, it says that there was no open vision. There was no clear message from God anymore. So if you can picture with me, as we look at the life of Samuel, think about this Israel as a whole collection, a confederation of tribes. They're not really a tightly gathered nation. Yes, they're banding together as needed for self-defense and war as their enemies threaten them. But really, everybody is just doing what they think ought to be done for the best interests of their own families and their own desires. And it's in this setting, this corrupt and decaying spiritual and civil setting, that we find the man Elkanah. And I think it's interesting, and Samuel probably draws a contrast here on purpose between the conditions that Samuel's parents found themselves in and who they were. So we have Elkanah, who is the father of Samuel. And Elkanah, it doesn't say specifically here in the beginning of the book of 1 Samuel, but Elkanah was a Levite, and not a descendant of Aaron. He was a descendant of Kohath. And he was living in the mountains of Ephraim. That's why it says he was an Ephrathite from Mount Ephraim. And so here was a Levite who was living in one of the cities that was assigned to the Levites. And he's apparently a godly man. Because even though the priests of God at Shiloh were corrupt, even though there was a lot of wicked things happening at the tabernacle, the Bible tells us that every year Elkanah was taking his family to Shiloh for the sacrifice. They clearly aren't following the law very closely, because the law specifically said that every male was to go to appear before God three times a year, but he's doing it once a year. I guess we can give him credit for at least going once, even if he didn't make it three times. I take Elkanah to be a godly man. He's taking his family to the place of worship, and he also supports his wife Hannah as she approaches God. He apparently also was not too poor. I noticed that as he sacrifices in 1 Samuel 1, verse 24, it says he brings three bullocks. So he apparently wasn't too poor of a man. He apparently had at least some wealth. But he certainly had a strange family setting. He had two wives, and we don't know why he had two wives. Likely because he couldn't have any children with Hannah, he married a second wife. And in this strange family setting, I see Elkanah trying to keep the peace. I don't think this was God's will for him, but he tries to comfort his wife and says to her, aren't I better to you than 10 sons? Don't I treat you better than having 10 sons would be? I don't think that's a good comparison. Probably fell short of what he was trying to do. But the long and short of it is, Samuel is born into unsettled and difficult and strange times. The Philistines at this point are oppressing Israel. This was the time of Samson approximately. So there was lots of conflict and oppression. And at one point it says the The only place you could get your weapon sharpened in this time period was to go down to the Philistines. And they charged such a high price for it that it was just unreasonable. And almost no one did to have any weapons. He was born into a stressful home situation. He had a godly father, but two mothers, and there was tension and conflict. So this is the scene, this is the place that Samuel is born into. And I think, well, I know for me, it helped me to understand or to have a better appreciation for who Samuel is as I looked at the setting he was born into. So I'd like to read from the book of 1 Samuel now to try to understand who was Samuel. Start reading in chapter 1, verse 9. I know we're just breaking into the story here. So in the story here, they've gone up to Shiloh to worship. And so Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by the post of the temple of the Lord. And she, that is Hannah, was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto the Lord, and wept sore, and vowed a vow, and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but wilt give unto thine handmaid a man child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. And it came to pass as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee. And Hannah answered and said, No, my lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the Lord and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. Dropping down a few verses, Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come, about after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, Because I have asked him of the Lord. She skips going to Shiloh for 1 year. In verse 25, they brought Samuel to the tabernacle when he was young. The child was young, it says, and they slew a bullock and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition which I asked of him. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there. It's a beautiful story, and I think it stands in such stark contrast to the lives of the people who are around Elkanah and Hannah. Instead of the wickedness and selfishness and general debauchery of the people of Israel, we have a godly woman who is coming to the house of God to pray and to seek a child. And this child is Samuel, and God blesses her with the child, Samuel. And one of the questions I had as I tried to understand what we could understand from the life of Samuel is, what made Samuel who he was? And we'll talk some more through the message here about what Samuel did. But what made Samuel the person he was? I would say it's clear, I think, from reading the book of Samuel that his parents were among the first things that made him who he was. Instead of ungodly parents who were seeking their own best wishes and comforts and desires, he had godly parents who were going to the tabernacle every year. He also had the example of his mother, a beautiful example of a dedicated woman who was dedicated to God. Her example of fervent prayer, I think, should stand out to us. And she stands in contrast to Eli, who apparently his only reference point is drunken people at the tabernacle. And I think it's a sad indictment of the people of God that he assumed that someone who is praying silently must be intoxicated. But instead, we have Hannah praying fervently in her spirit and calling out to God. But I want us to notice her confident faith. So she prays earnestly. She pours out her heart to God. This is a stressful thing. Every year they go up to the tabernacle to worship. And as part of the service, you know, they're eating the meat that's offered. And, of course, the other wife gets a whole bunch of food for her children and for her. But for Hannah, it's just herself. And so every year as they came to worship, there would be this vivid reminder that she doesn't have any children. But after she prays, she receives the blessing of God from Eli. Eli says, "Go in peace, and God grant thee thy petition." And she takes that and goes in faith. It says that her, so the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. I think there was something that happened in Hannah's heart there, which she said, yes, I believe that God is going to do this. A beautiful example of faith. Not only did she have faith, but she followed through on her commitment. As I considered and tried to put myself into the story as it's happening here, so if for years she's been longing for a child, she makes this promise that she'll give him back to the Lord, and then she does have a child. So now what's she going to do? The law did make a provision that if you made a vow and it came time to keep your vow, that you could pay money to fulfill your vow instead of the thing that you were going to give to God. And the one author I read suggested that if she would have wanted to, there would have been loopholes she could have exploited to make it come out right, you know, where she could still have her child at home with her and still fulfill her vow to God. But I see a faithful woman who does literally keep her vow to God. She said, "I've committed this child to God once he's weaned." And at this point, he's probably 3 or 4 years old at the oldest. It's a tender young age. And she says, "I promise him to God, he's going to God." That's the way it is. And so I think really the first thing that I think shaped Samuel into who he was the example of his parents and especially of his mother. The other thing that shaped Samuel is his calling from God. I think we're familiar with this story, at least those of us who are older are. But I'd like for us to consider it in detail for the children's sake. And I'd like for you children to listen closely to this story. The other thing that shaped Samuel very much was his specific calling from God. And think about it. We don't know how old Samuel was at this point. He's obviously been at Shiloh for some time now, but still a child. So my guess is he's probably somewhere in the 4 to 10-year-old range. So I think most of you children who came up and sat on the bank here would have been in that age bracket that Samuel likely was at this point in the story. And so we have Samuel, the child, helping Eli at the tabernacle. And I'm picturing him running errands. For you children, you could think about being at the church and maybe somebody needs to go open the doors up, somebody needs to unlock the doors or turn the lights on or to refill the water pitcher or carry firewood, take out the trash. That's what I picture Samuel doing here in the tabernacle. He's doing the little jobs that just had to be done around the place. And so on this day, they come to the end of the day, and Eli is getting old. He's laying down. It says he's laid down in his place. He can't see very well. It's in the evening, and Samuel is laying down to go to bed. And as he's laying there, he hears a voice calling his name. And this voice calls Samuel. And for you children, you could fill in your own names. There's a voice calling Adam or Tristan. And the only voice he knows of is Eli calling him to do some other job. So he obviously thinks, well, Eli must have something he forgot about. So he gets up and goes to Eli and says, here I am. You called me. And Eli says, no, I didn't call you. Go lie down. And he goes back and lies down. And here's the voice again. And this happens three times. And the third time, Eli realizes that something else is happening. This is more than just this little boy hearing things. And I'm sure you little people and parents know that sometimes children hear things or imagine things, and children's imaginations are generally pretty good. But Eli knows that there's something else here than just an overactive imagination. I want to remind you, children, to pay attention to Samuel, though. Three times he gets up out of his bed and goes to talk to Eli to find out what Eli wanted. I don't know about all of you children, but I know the children in my household generally aren't real enthused about doing that. Once they're comfortable, they don't necessarily want to get up and go. And maybe they'll try to answer from their bed or answer from where they are and say, yeah, what do you want? But notice Samuel, he got up and went to Eli and said, what do you want? And after the third time, Eli instructs Samuel and says, the next time you hear this, you need to acknowledge it as from God and say, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. And Samuel does that. He says, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. And he receives a word from God. And I found this fascinating to think about this message that Samuel gets from God. The first word from God to Samuel is not a charge to Samuel. So if you compare this to other prophets in the scriptures, usually God comes to the prophet and says, I want you to do something. Or here is a mission for you to carry out. Or here is an instruction for you. But the message from God to Samuel is not a charge to Samuel, not an instruction to do something. And it's not a warning to Eli either. Because if you read the story, you'll find out that Eli has been very generously warned up to this point and has been told over and over again what's going to happen for the wickedness in his family. But I see God revealing himself to Samuel and showing what is right. Putting God's message to Samuel in my own words, I would say God told Samuel, I am about to do something shocking that will disturb anyone who sees or hears about it. He said, I am going to punish Eli and his house for the wickedness that they've done. And I think what God is doing is showing Samuel who he is in the context that Samuel finds himself in. If you think about this, this is a young child growing up in a wicked environment. This is a young child in his impressionable years around men who are immoral, priests who are stealing from the congregation. What's going to prevent Samuel from being drawn into the same wickedness and evil that Eli's sons are doing? And I picture this message to Samuel is God saying, this is who I am, and I am not going to put up with this evil that you're observing in the people around you. We need to move on. There's so much we could say about Samuel. What shaped him was his parents, the calling from God, the context he lived in that shaped him very definitely. What can we learn from Samuel? And this, I think, is the core of the message for today. What can we learn from the story of Samuel? You know, I think the first thing that we should learn from the story of Samuel, and you can read this and look for it as you think about or read or listen to the story of Samuel. There is, I think, in the world, a tendency to separate our spiritual lives and our physical lives. I think that's a mistake. It's easy for us to come to church Sunday morning and we listen to messages, we hear scriptures read, And we can go back to our daily lives, and it can feel like a totally separate realm, a totally separate context and place. But I think the message of the core of the story of Samuel would tell us that the spiritual guides and shapes our physical lives. If you look at the lives of Eli and his sons, it doesn't seem like there's much spiritual vigor or vitality there. They don't seem to be that interested in pursuing God. And the outcome of their lives is destruction and defeat and judgment from God. And you can compare that to the lives of Samuel's parents, who seem very dedicated and very interested in pursuing God and knowing God, teaching their children, taking them to worship, and there's a whole different set of outcomes. We could go to chapters 4, 5, and 6 in Samuel, and we don't have time to read it. But it's clear here, and in the end of the book of Judges, where God's people were lackadaisical, they were relaxed in their approach to their spiritual lives, it only led to physical defeat and confusion. And you could take for comparison, and this requires reading lots of chapters or listening to lots of chapters, but I would challenge you to think about or read about the story of the life of Samuel and the life of Saul. And you'll see that Samuel's pursuit of godliness leads to a very different result than the life of Saul. Secondly, I think we should take a lesson from the statement at the book of Judges where it says, where every man did what was right in his own eyes, and realized that that is not a good path to follow. It did not work well for Israel, for everyone to take their own path. It led to defeat, it led to confused morality, and if you just read the stories of the judges, there are some strange situations. You could read about Abimelech, of Gideon, and other judges, and I wonder why God even allowed them to lead his people. But I think if you look at the story of Samuel, you'll find that when God's people rallied together behind spiritual leadership, and if we had time, I would read I thought I wrote this reference down. There are various times throughout the book of Samuel where Samuel calls Israel together and they seek God. And you'll notice that it's at those times when Samuel calls God's people together, that's when they make progress, when they have victory. It's when they all pursued their own opinions, their own thoughts, that they went backwards, were captured, or were in defeat. As I thought about us as a church, our church tradition in the Beachy churches, I would say, is one of acceptance and opening and an openness to working with others. That's a real strength, but it's also a weakness, I think. If we all do just what's right in our own eyes, it will lead to division and defeat, I believe. And it's a danger in our autonomous churches where each church does its own thing. And as a leadership team, we were discussing this morning and talking about how we're going to approach this whole thing of services outside or services inside, or how we're going to do this. And one of the challenges, you know, this church that we fellowship is doing it this way, and this other church is doing it that way. It would actually be helpful if we had a unified approach that we could all say, yes, this is how we do it, and could give an ease to our leadership and our certainty about proceeding with things. I believe that the life of Samuel could tell us that God put spiritual leadership in place for a reason, and that honoring the spiritual leadership over us is to honor God. And I take this from the example of Samuel. You'll notice that as Samuel hears from God, there's nothing to indicate that Samuel starts to disobey Eli at this point and says, well, if God's going to judge you, that I don't have to listen to what you have to say. I see Samuel continuing to serve under Eli and to serve at the tabernacle with no inclination that he felt like he needed to do otherwise. God put spiritual leadership in place for a reason, and I think that it's a lesson we should take from Samuel to follow that leadership and to listen and follow the call of God through it. After all, it was Eli who helped Samuel recognize the voice of God, even though Eli was not the man of God he should have been. Moving on, in closing, the last lesson I think we should take from the life of Samuel is from Samuel chapter 2. And I didn't read this, but I wanted to come back to it. In God's judgment to Eli, in the book of Samuel here, there is a simple phrase that I think we ought to take notice of. In chapter 2, verse 30, God is speaking to Eli through a man of God who comes to him and tells him of the judgment that's coming. God says in verse 30, he says, "Wherefore the God of Israel saith, I said indeed that thy house," meaning Eli's house, "and the house of thy father should walk before me forever. But now the Lord saith, be it far from me, for them that honor me I will honor, and they that despise me shall be lightly esteemed." And he goes on to talk some more about the judgment on Eli, but I want to stop there. The lesson I think we should take from the life of Samuel, as contrasted to the life of Eli, is that God honors those who honor him. It's clear from the story of Eli and Samuel that Eli chose his own sons over God. He could have stopped them from being priests. He could have stepped in and said, "This is not right. You're doing wrong. You need to not be a priest anymore." He could have set things right in the worship services, but he didn't. He chose his sons and their comforts and what they wanted to do over God. And as a result, God's judgment on Eli and his sons was dire. And if you read the story in Samuel, you'll realize that God's prophecy did come true and Eli's family is wiped out. But in contrast to that, we see Samuel, someone who did honor God or sought to honor God, and God honors Samuel. And throughout his life, God puts him in a position of being a judge, a civil leader. He's the priest. He's recognized as the spiritual leader in Shiloh, and he's offering sacrifices. And he's the kingmaker. He's the one who anoints David and Saul both to be kings. Not only that, he leads God's people to victory over the Philistines and goes on in many ways to be the voice of God to God's people. And if you only remember one thing from this message, make it this: God honors those who honor him, and those who despise God will lose honor. I see that in Samuel's life, a desire to honor God. And I want to live for God's honor. That means that what other people are doing, while it's not inconsequential, and while I don't have some respect for what other people do, I want to put first what God values. I want to denounce what God denounces and put away everything that's morally questionable so that I can live to honor God. In closing, 2 Timothy 2:19 says, "The foundation of the Lord standeth sure, having the seal, the Lord knoweth them that are his, and let everyone that nameth the name of Christ depart from iniquity." Let's bow our heads for prayer. Our Father in heaven, I thank you for the examples you give us in your word of godly men. And I thank you for the example of Samuel, who from a young age hears your call and responds to your voice. Father, I pray that all of us, as we consider how to live our lives, would look to you in faith and honor what you honor and despise what you despise. And Father, I pray that you'd help us to understand that, both in our personal lives and as a collective body, as a church. Help us to know how to follow you closely and to lay aside the things of this world that would pull us down. This we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.